I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. He brooded on every slight, declared the press his enemy, and held office during a time when many Americans felt divided. Does that ring a bell? Richard Nixon was a political outsider who ran for president on an anti-elite platform for the silent majority. Today we'll speak with a historian whose latest biography of the 37th president has many readers drawing parallels with President Trump. From his political jumpstart after the end of World War II to the infamous Watergate scandal, we'll explore the history of Richard Nixon and find out how his presidency mirrors today. Later, we'll bring you the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When most people hear the name Richard Nixon, they think about Watergate, about political corruption at the highest levels of American politics. In a new book about Nixon, author John Farrell concludes that Watergate was a natural outgrowth of decades of political manipulation and deceit, reaching back to Richard Nixon's first race for Congress in the 1940s. In John Farrell's book, Richard Nixon emerges as the conundrum that he's been for so many Americans for so many years. He's the kid from lower class middle-class California, an introvert who rises to the top of American politics with a chip on his shoulder, always envious, always full of self-pity. The book is Richard Nixon, The Life. John Farrell is the author of books on Clarence Darrow and Tip O'Neill. He's worked at the Denver Post and the Boston Globe, where he served as White House correspondent and as well on the Spotlight investigative team. John, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks. That was a wonderful introduction. I think that you like said it all. I can just turn off the mic now.
I wish it was that easy, John, but it's not. Don't go anywhere right now, John. That would be bad.
Okay.
Well, with this week's firing of FBI Director James Comey, I mean, the question that has been asked so often, do you see any comparisons between that move and the Saturday night massacre that involved Richard Nixon in the throes of the Watergate scandal?
Oh, absolutely. The firing of a high-level Justice Department official who is investigating you was the definition of the Saturday Night Massacre, and that is what happened this week. I think that in the case of the Nixon administration, we know now that the White House was covering something up. In the case of the Trump administration, we don't have that knowledge. We have lots of questions, and I think that sort of calls for the kind of 9/11 commission or select committee approach to get to the bottom of things so we can make that determination. Trump and Nixon were different personalities, and this could just be, you know, Donald Trump sitting in his office watching Comey testify, looking up at the portrait of Andrew Jackson and saying, I'm going to fire the guy, and going ahead and doing it because everybody used to love it when he did it on television. We can't reach that bottom line conclusion, as in the Saturday Night Massacre of 1973, that there was something going on, but it certainly does strike chords of memory.
So how does Richard Nixon compare to Donald Trump? I mean, what are the similarities? What are the differences, John?
I think the similarities are that they both are all political rather than personal. They both campaigned trying to touch people's resentments, sense of grievances, fears. Trump's very specifically quoted from Nixon's speeches, called upon the silent majority to follow him in a law and order campaign when he campaigned last fall. Nixon was a very troubled, insecure, almost self-loathing person, which does not seem to be Trump's problems. But Nixon's great talent was that he could identify these qualities in the voters. He could reach out. He could see their fears and their uncertainties, and he had this wonderful way of addressing them and sort of tapping that anger. And we didn't think it was happening very well for Trump last fall, but in the end, it did. He convinced large numbers of Americans that things were worse off than they thought, and that he had some solutions. And there he was, surprising everybody on January 20th, taking the oath of office.
Hmm. I want to go back to Richard Nixon's first political race in 1946, and your coverage of this race in the book really surprised me because I didn't realize the extent to which corruption played into that race as well. Nixon runs against a well-established and highly respected Democrat at the time. And of this race, Nixon would say later, "I had to win. I had to win." What do you make of that? Because it seems to me it set a template for the years to come.
It did. That's a good point. He always started out with good intentions, and he always, and this was a pattern that repeated itself many times. And in that campaign, his early correspondence, he talks about campaigning on a platform of practical liberalism and of bringing up the issue of civil rights in 1946, unheard of. But once he gets into the give and take of the race, his insecurities and his neuroses come into play, and he reaches for the quick hit, the most aggressive path, and that is to paint Jerry Voorhees, who was his opponent, a New Deal liberal, as in fact a dupe of the communists. And the more that worked, the more Nixon was successful at it, the harder he pushed it. Until even his some of his own campaign advisors were concerned that he was going too far. And in the course of all that, you see the first hint of Nixon's penchant for skullduggery.
He wants a spy inside the opposing camp.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He used to sit there with a yellow legal pad and make all the lists of things he had to do the next day. And there on one of those yellow legal pads, he writes, you know, "Insert spy into Voorhees' camp."
That's just amazing. That's just, well, why did he want to try his hand at politics to begin with? Because he's coming out of the war. He's not sure what he wanted to do. He had several options, or at least things he was considering. Why did he pick politics?
He was always a reader. He always was reading history and biography. He was the kind of, he grew up in the outback of California. There's a picture in the book which shows Yorba Linda when he was living there, and it looks like Oklahoma in the Dust Bowl days. And so he was the kind of kid who was always trudging to the next neighbor's house to borrow that month's National Geographic when they were finished with it. So he always had that basic interest. And he was a very bright boy, bright man, all the way through the presidency, of course. And he had a sort of a blustery father who was filled with political opinions and was always, in addition to being abusive to his sons, was always talking about politics and talking in sort of stark populist terms.
Abusive how, John?
Abusive both mentally and probably physically. I mean, it's awful hard to tell because everybody got spanked in those days.
Right.
But all the Nixon boys, you know, and the Nixon neighbors report that Frank Nixon had an outrageous temper and took it out on his sons. Nixon's mother was from a quiet Quaker family, but she was a very silent woman, and she used to retreat into her closet to pray. And as Nixon famously said, "Never once in my life did she ever tell me that she loved me." So on one hand, he had this sort of progressive push from the Quaker side. On the other hand, he had this sort of raw populist push from his dad. And that probably is what got him into politics. The most striking thing about Nixon is he did it all alone. He never had a mentor. He never had a big financial machine backing him. He never had a name like Kennedy or an Ivy League degree. And the second most striking thing is that when he would get knocked down, he would have this amazing resiliency, always popping back up again, the new Nixon and the latest comeback. So he had many, many admirable qualities. And the original subtitle of the book was to be Richard Nixon, an American Tragedy, because he really was a classic tragic figure with this fatal character flaw that he just could not overcome.
You know, he didn't have the connections of a Kennedy. He didn't have the Ivy League background. He didn't have the money. And as a result, there's a sense you have, and you talk about it here so much, he had this giant chip on his shoulder all the time.
All the time, and especially when it came to criticism. He was almost immediately favored by the Southern California conservatives, and they had a tight control on the news media in the Los Angeles Times, which dominated coverage in that area. So from the beginning, he had sort of this warped view of the press, that the press took sides, could be bought, had its own interests. And then when he got to Washington and was subjected to the rough and tumble of the East Coast press, people who were antagonistic to them. He identified them just as personal political enemies, and always did. There's an amazing moment in the middle of the crisis in the Vietnam War, where he's talking to Henry Kissinger, and all of a sudden he starts saying, and you can see this on YouTube, where a lot of these tapes are available, and he starts saying, "The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. Write that on your blackboard, Henry, 100 times. The professors are the enemy. The establishment is the enemy. The press is the enemy." So he had this real, he himself called it paranoia, so I'm not exaggerating in saying that.
So given this background of his, you wonder where his drive to succeed came from, or maybe it was because of his background, he was so desperate to get away from it.
Yeah, one of his close aides, a fellow named Bryce Harlow, said that Richard Nixon climbed up the walls of life with his claws. And that was a pretty good description.
His political buoyancy over the years, as you've mentioned here, is just remarkable. I mean, today, you can't imagine someone serving in the U.S. House, then the Senate, 2 terms as vice president, then running for president and narrowly losing, and then, John, bouncing back 8 years later to win yet another close race for the White House. That type of longevity doesn't happen anymore, and it's simply amazing as you look back at his career.
Yeah, he was on the national ticket 5 times.
Wow.
Twice as vice president, 3 times as president. Won 4 of those, if you count the Eisenhower victories when he was running as the vice president. People used to call the second half of the 20th century the age of Nixon. And, of course, he ends his time in office, of course, with Watergate, but also with these huge foreign policy triumphs, with the first strategic arms limitation treaty that all his predecessors would have died to have signed, and the brilliant stroke of driving a wedge between China and Russia by bringing China out into the family of nations. Probably the single biggest moment in the Cold War that gave us 50 years of peace without another world war. I mean, that was a big deal to bring China out of its isolation. And no matter what problems we have with them on trade these days, it's much better to be dealing with them the way we are than to have let them defester, as Nixon said, let them stew in their own juices, and then confront a belligerent nuclear China somewhere in the late 20th century.
I'm visiting with John Farrell about his new book, Richard Nixon, The Life. So as you look ahead here, very early in the book, you say he wasn't easy to like. His preferred posture was to sit, as you pointed out, in an easy chair with a legal pad on his lap, staring off into the distance and just thinking, always deep in thought. Now, none of that strikes me as a description of anything close to a natural politician.
No, Nixon, in fact, used to make fun of himself. He used to say that I'm an introvert in an extrovert's profession.
Yes.
It was all done by will. There was this great moment in that first campaign where his aides came to him and they said, "Dick, we have a problem." He said, "What is it?" And he said, "Well, you're great in the Rotary Clubs or the JCs where everybody in the audience is male. But when we put you in a mixed company or a Republican women's club, you can't look women in the eye." And they said, "It's the weirdest thing, and you're not going to get elected if you can't look at half the electorate face to face." And it was, could possibly have just been shyness. It could be some deep-seated thing that had to do with his mother's coldness. But Nixon had to work at it. And Nixon, when told that he had to work at something, he had the discipline and he had the acting ability, had the acting chops, that he could force himself to rehearse and rehearse. And so this was out in Southern California when Scripps College at the time was all female. And they gathered a bunch of what was called co-eds in those times into a living room. And they tested him and they put him there and they said, "Okay, see if you can do it." And he had forced himself and trained himself. And he took an hour and he answered all their questions without losing his temper, without being distracted and looking away. And all his managers heaved a giant sigh of relief. And he would do that over and over and over again because he was not a natural politician.
Go
ahead.
Well, I was going to say, to what extent does he wind up resenting someone like John Kennedy who it came to him so much more easily?
Well, the interesting thing about the Kennedy relationship is how much they liked each other. They were almost blood brothers in the early relationship. And there's this amazing scene where John Kennedy had a major operation on his back and almost died. And Richard Nixon is seen in the halls of Walter Reed Hospital, clutching the wall and saying, "Poor brave Jack, poor brave Jack is going to die." And they were very close. Jack and Jackie invited Pat and Dick to their wedding. They JFK and Nixon both had the same sort of very religious, cold mother. So they've made perhaps they identified about that. They both had a burning interest in Cold War politics. They both were internationalists. One of the and Kennedy admired Nixon. He called him the kind of man this country needs in these days. In part because Nixon, who came from this very conservative Southern California district that was all against foreign aid, opposed the Marshall Plan. Nixon went over with an investigative committee to Europe, came back, and he campaigned for 6 months in his district, talking to all those Rotary Clubs, all those Chamber of Commerces and JCs, and persuaded his district to support the Marshall Plan. It was a classic challenge of a representative to turn the opinion of his district rather than following their instinct, and it was quite a risk. His political career could have ended immediately.
If our listeners want to join our conversation about Richard Nixon, 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, you had access to several hundred oral histories that had been kept sealed until just a few years ago in 2012. Tell us about these and how valuable they were to you, John.
The oral histories were conducted during the Nixon years when he was president. Somebody said, well, you know, we need to go out and get all of his neighbors and relatives, his grandparents and aunts and uncles before they pass away. And so that was a very thorough, extensive job that was done. Nixon's brother participated in it. His daughter, Julie, did a short oral history. Many of his aunts and uncles and cousins, neighbors, teachers, and all going all the way back to his infancy. And for some reason, it was put away into the closet and between the National Archives and Whittier College, and it didn't come out until two or three years ago. And so it gave me this immense, rich set of interviews in which to base those early years. And at the same time, and there must be something about the 40-year rule in presidents, because at the same time, then the presidential papers and the vice presidential papers were beginning to flow as well. And all the Nixon aides from his presidency sat down and did a separate set of oral histories with the Nixon library out there in Yorba Linda. And so this was a case where I had almost too much to work with. And finally, there's, of course, this amazing resource, the White House tapes, which finished the first round of them finished coming out while I was working on the book. So I had all of them to tap as well. At times I felt I was like drinking from a fire hydrant.
I was going to say, because one of the things you had access to was Bob Halderman's private White House diary and secret reports from the 68 presidential campaign. How did you get your hands on those?
I like to say it was luck, but I have to give myself at least credit for having an iron butt and sitting there and turning every page. Mm-hmm. And I came upon, in particular, in the 68 campaign notes, gave a lot of insight into two major parts of that campaign. The first was the so-called Southern strategy, in which Nixon always denied that he had made a deal with the devil, a deal with the segregationist South, in order to get their support at the Republican convention. And here was a piece of paper with Haldeman's notes of being given the instruction from Nixon to go to the Southern chairman and tell them that Nixon promised that he would, quote, cut out the pro-Negro crap, unquote, if they stuck with him. And the second thing was a few weeks later.
That's got to be just a moment for you as a researcher where you just about jump out of your chair, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, you know,
what
the funny thing about the funny thing about Nixon and civil rights too, and when you do this research on these people, you really begin to understand them, and you feel like you know them, and you come across something like that, and my initial reaction to that was, "Aw, Dick, you know, come on, I thought you were better than that." So it's not all eureka, I guess is my point.
That's interesting.
But there was a eureka moment with the other big thing in the Haldeman notes, which was that for many, many decades, it has been thought or rumored that Nixon sent an envoy to the South Vietnamese to foil the Lyndon Johnson's peace talks. And
this is right before the 1968 election that became very close between Nixon and Hubert Humphrey.
Right, exactly. And Johnson wanted to leave office with some kind of peace settlement in Vietnam because this was the big black mark against his career. And Nixon got wind of it and had a intermediary go to the South Vietnamese, which we know that she did because the U.S. was eavesdropping and captured her words on tape. And so Johnson heard about it, and he called up Nixon, and there's a classic, again, White House tape of the Johnson Library, of Nixon denying that he had anything to do with it. And then again on David Frost in the famous interviews, Nixon denied he had anything to do with it.
And
here's this piece of paper of him talking to Haldeman, and he's saying, do whatever we can to Monkey Ranch, Johnson's peace initiative. And this woman, Anna Chenault, that he has deputized, goes to the South Vietnamese and says, hold on, drag your feet. Nixon's going to win and you'll get a better deal. And so he put the Johnson's peace initiative in severe jeopardy.
This is one of the great revelations in your book, and I don't want to gloss over this too quickly because the consequences of this action were simply enormous in terms of lives lost and everything else here, right?
Well, you cannot make the argument that this was a moment where there was a deal that would be struck. The South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese proved to be incredibly stubborn. But we do know that the Russians were pressuring the North Vietnamese at that moment. We do know from their internal records that the Johnson administration truly believed they had a chance for peace before they left office. So there was this moment of hope. And the interesting thing as a biographer, or the compelling thing as a biographer, is that I'm trying to examine Richard Nixon's character. And I'm saying, wow, you know, here was a guy that, to get himself elected, was willing to play with all these lives. You can't make this direct connection and say that because Nixon did this, the war went on for 5 more years and 20,000 Americans died and 1 million Cambodians died and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese died.
But the possibility
is far
more
complex.
Yeah.
And the willingness of a cunning politician to take this risk. I thought that I argue in the book that this was more reprehensible than anything that he had done in Watergate.
Because
of the lives at stake.
Yeah. You go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Justin from downtown Kansas City. Justin, you're on with John Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning. John, I got a question for you, and it is this. Do you think that Nixon's upbringing in that abusive household and the coldness of his mother had anything to do with his intense disdain for the criticism that the press put upon him?
I definitely feel that it left him with a lifelong insecurity and almost a self-loathing. There's several times during his career where Nixon lets slip the idea that writing in his girlfriend's yearbook or writing this little note to his baby niece who's just been born, or later in the David Frost interviews where he says, I'm an unlovable man. So to think of that all your life, that people don't love you, and then to choose politics as a profession is an example of his will. But I think that it also shows that that developed in time over paranoia. And then when the press, who took joys in baiting him and which were most definitely left-leaning during the McCarthy era and the Kennedy campaign in 1960, at least at the reporting level, all sort of mushroomed into this classic battle that other politicians could, everybody, George Washington, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, they all had problems with the press. They all, at some point or the other, just like threw down their quill or their pen and said, boy, it would be so much easier if it wasn't for these jokers. But Nixon was the one president that let it get to him.
John Farrell's our guest. He's the author of the new book, Richard Nixon, The Life, highly praised book, getting a lot of positive reviews. After a break, we'll talk about Watergate. We'll talk about that narrow loss in 1960 to Jack Kennedy and a whole lot more. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with a Johnson County cyclist who's on a 9,000-mile journey following the monarch butterflies. And we visited with Angel Flight that flies patients to the medical care they need. Find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the filmmaker behind the new documentary that looks at the life and work of the revolutionary jazz legend John Coltrane. That's tomorrow on the show. This hour, we're talking with John Farrell about his new biography of Richard Nixon. It's titled Richard Nixon, The Life. John, why did Dwight Eisenhower in 1952 tap Richard Nixon to be his vice presidential running mate? Nixon had been in Congress just for, 6 years or so. So why Dick Nixon instead of somebody else?
Yeah, amazing thing about Nixon's career, as you point out, is that he went from absolutely a nobody to vice president of the United States in 6 years, which is, almost unheard of. There were several reasons. Like everything in politics, there are demographic reasons and there are sort of skullduggery reasons. Nixon was young. He was from California, an increasingly important state, and he represented that generation of young men who had fought World War II and had come home and had with a determination that they were going to change things for the better and that all their buddies who had died had not died in vain, that they were going to make a better, newer world. And so those were sort of the honorable reasons why Eisenhower would look for Nixon. The more political reason was that Nixon had helped Eisenhower get the nomination. At the time, Earl Warren, later to become Supreme Court Chief Justice, was the governor of California, and he was running for president as well against Eisenhower. And Nixon, as the senator from California, undermined Warren's control of the California delegation, especially on a series of very key procedural votes at the convention that allowed Eisenhower to claim victory. And because of that, the Warren people never forgave Richard Nixon. Earl Warren never forgave Richard Nixon. He would always draw his finger across his throat in the universal signal of a throat cutter whenever he spoke of Nixon and what Nixon had done to him in 1950.
So Nixon is running for vice president, and he becomes embroiled in a scandal, even before he becomes vice president, that led to his famous checker speech. What was that all about?
Well, like many of the episodes recounted in the book, because we're entering now the age of television, you can go online, your listeners can go online and listen to Nixon and watch him give the checker speech. It was probably the greatest use of television by a political candidate in the 20th century, in that it was so new and it was so effective. As you said, Nixon had been accused of having this slush fund and the leak actually came from the Earl Warren camp. All of a sudden, his candidacy and even the Eisenhower candidacy was at stake. And there were many advisors to Eisenhower who wanted him to dump Nixon from the ticket. But they figured they'd give Dick a chance, and he got a half hour of television on the same night as the Milton Berle show. And he gave the speech from the same theater where during the day Abbott and Costello did their broadcasts. But he went on television and speaking without notes from behind a desk and then walking around the desk and standing up and clenching his fists. He gives this amazing performance, and he turns the entire thing around. And when that speech is over, hundreds of thousands of telegrams and letters flow into Republican headquarters or the Eisenhower campaign saying, keep Dick Nixon. And the further significance of that speech, not just that it resurrected Nixon's career and that it showed the power of television, but the other significance of that speech was that this was the first time that a Republican politician had reached out to middle America, the people that would later become Nixon's great silent majority. Mm-hmm. Up until this point, the Republican Party had always been identified as the party of Wall Street and bankers and financiers and corporate executives. And this was one of middle America's own talking about the fact that his wife had a good Republican cloth coat, not a mink coat, talking about his mortgage, and of course talking about the little dog checkers that had been sent in by a supporter to his daughters. And though nobody ever suggested such a thing, Nixon bravely said, and you know what? They're never going to take that dog away from my girls because they love the dog. That's a great moment.
It's a great moment. How close did Dwight Eisenhower, how close were they as president and vice president?
Well, this was very painful to Richard Nixon. It wasn't painful to Eisenhower. Eisenhower was the liberator of Europe. He was the former Supreme Commander. He had been dealing with personalities like Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt and George Patton. So for him, Richard Nixon was an underling. He was a second lieutenant. He was staff. Mm-hmm. He was somebody who could prove useful on certain missions that was while Eisenhower ran the show. And, of course, Nixon, who probably idolized Eisenhower as a substitute dad, was just torn to pieces by this. Was still raw enough and inexperienced enough as a politician that when he would try too hard and he would ruffle Eisenhower's feathers. And then the great tragic moment comes when Eisenhower has a heart attack and Nixon performs perfectly. He shows tact. He shows reserve. He shows coolness under pressure. And he finally thinks that he's made his way up into Eisenhower's inner circle. And Eisenhower calls him up and says, you know, Dick, I want to drop you from the ticket next time when we run for reelection. Mm-hmm. And Nixon's just crushed. He's devastated. There were several times during the Eisenhower years where Dick and Pat Nixon thought that they would be leaving politics because they couldn't take it.
And why didn't Eisenhower dump him?
Because Nixon fought for it, as with everything in his life that he got, Dick Nixon struggled hard and fought for it, and he had he would go out. He was the guy while Eisenhower played golf at Augusta or went out to the Rockies to do trout fishing. Nixon was the guy who went to every chicken dinner in the Republican Party and went to every congressman who was calling, who needed somebody to speak or raise money for him. And so Nixon had developed this great network of fans and friends and people who had obligation to him in the Republican Party. And he tapped it, most specifically in a brilliant move. One of his supporters wrote in Nixon's name in the New Hampshire primary and showed Eisenhower just how deep Nixon's support was among the Republican Party. And so despite Eisenhower's, you know, doubts about Nixon's capacity to be president, he kept him on the ticket. And by the time the second term goes around, it's very clear that Nixon is going to be Eisenhower's successor, and that sets him up for the 1960 campaign.
Which he loses narrowly to Jack Kennedy. Perhaps the election was stolen. Maybe we'll never know. How did Richard Nixon react to that defeat?
This was a turning point in his life, in small part, because he had been friends with Jack Kennedy, and he saw it as a personal betrayal. He also was envious of everything that the Kennedys mm-hmm. had. Charisma, good looks, yes. Money, everything that Dick didn't have. Dick played by the rules. He was the ugly duckling, and Kennedy was the black swan. And so Nixon was convinced that they had stolen the election from him in Illinois and in Texas, both of which were decided by just a few thousand votes. And his daughter Julie told me or confirmed to me that her father left that experience determined that he would never be out-cheated again, that he was going to be tougher. He was going to be slicker than anybody that he ran against thereafter. And that was a big turning point in his life, and in some ways sort of set him down the road to Watergate, because in time after time you hear on the tapes him referring to the Kennedys and referring to the Democratic opponents and you know, they play it tough and we're going to play it tough. We're going to be as good as they are. You know, they bugged me. I'm going to bug them. Bob, we need you to go out and bug. We need you to go out and find evidence of scandal. There's a direct line there.
And there's such tragedy. There's such pathos in what you just said.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing about Richard Nixon is that he did so much good in his life. He was, at certain points in his life, he did amazing things for civil rights that he never got any credit for. Mm-hmm. He created the Environmental Protection Agency. He created OSHA. He created a passed or signed the National Environmental Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. Mm-hmm. He added cost of living raises to Social Security. He cut the age of voting from 21 to 18 and did away with the draft. The list goes on and on and on of all the things that is Title IX, the ability of young women to have equal athletic facilities in college. Nixon was getting lots of feedback from people like Ohio State coach Woody Hayes and the president of Notre Dame saying, you can't do this. It's going to take money away from our football programs. And he wasn't thrilled about it, but he did it. He did a lot of good things. China, of course, the SALT treaties. But he had this tragic flaw. And you know, this isn't John Farrell saying this. This is, you go back to the writings of Henry Kissinger, his phone conversations at the time, or the diaries of Elliot Richardson, the attorney general that resigned in the Saturday Night Massacre. And they talk repeatedly about Nixon, you know, fulfilling the classic Greek or Shakespearean tragic hero. You know, just this amazing guy with so many gifts, and yet drawn inexorably towards his own defeat because he had these flaws.
Why did he think he could win in 1968 after the previous losses? What was it that made him think the country would give him one more chance?
It was a set of the stars aligned in the Republican Party. You know, the Republicans had taken their first fling with far-right conservatism with Barry Goldwater in 64. And now, they having seen how bad they lost, they decided that they were going to be more practical. And so they were willing to look to Nixon. In the general election, it was very, very close, one of the closest elections ever. Nixon lost in 1960 and won in 1968 by the barest of margins, in part because George Wallace, who was the Alabama governor running as an independent, took a lot of Democratic blue-collar votes away from Hubert Humphrey. There was that skullduggery at the end that we talked about over Vietnam.
Right.
But the amazing thing, when you go back and you look at the newspapers and you page through the commentary, even the far liberal commentary, they're all talking about the fact that 1968 was such a drastic, violent year. It was the year of the two assassinations, Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. It was the riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And so even people like Norman Mailer and Hunter Thompson were saying that, you know, the mature Nixon is a guy we ought to adopt. He's the guy who can get us out of this incredible time of turmoil. And even young Navy Lieutenant Bob Woodward voted for Richard Nixon in 1968.
So Watergate, then, to maybe wrap up all this conversation, you know, he invests in Watergate, gets involved in Watergate. This is a natural outgrowth of patterns that at that point had gone back decades.
Yeah, one thing we found out very quickly was that Nixon was the victim of a double standard, because the intelligence agencies under administrations going back to World War II, as the government grew with the foreign threats of totalitarianism, justified all sorts of amazing things. You know, hiring the mafia to assassinate foreign leaders, giving drugs like LSD to unsuspecting Americans so that they could see how they affected people. Opening mail. Nixon himself was the target of one of the huge surveillance programs that the federal government was running in those Cold War times. And it all came out in a congressional investigation run by Frank Church, and so it was known as the Church Committee Reports. And you find that, put in context, Nixon's crimes were different from the others in one major respect, in that for every president before him, the FBI had done the dirty work. J. Edgar Hoover had been glad to be the guy who sent his agents in to burglarize and to wiretap and to to surveil folks and to tail them and to infiltrate political organizations. It had all been done by the Bureau. And Hoover was approaching the end of his life, and he wanted to go out. He saw that times were changing. The 60s had changed things, and people weren't going to tolerate this behavior. And he told Nixon that. He refused to do some of these things for Nixon. And Nixon then decided that he would set up his own little in-house shop. He brought in Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, former failed intelligence agents, set them up next door to the White House in the executive office building, and sent them out to burglarize the psychiatrist's office of Daniel Ellsberg, who had leaked the secret study on the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers, to the press. And they so botched that that, of course, in classic Washington bureaucratic style, they were promoted to be somebody else's problem. They were sent over to the Republican National Committee, where under no supervision whatsoever, they managed to get their hands on $500,000 and went out and got caught burglarizing the Watergate headquarters, Democratic headquarters.
John Farrell.
Of course, one more similarity to where we are today. Yeah.
John Farrell's new book, Richard Nixon, The Life Again. It's got great reviews, a great read. Sure, appreciate you taking the time, John, and all the best with the book.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Time for a break. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
I'm all right. Nobody but about me. Why you got to give me a fight? Can't you just let it be?
Well, look who's here. I cut in on his line, didn't I? Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekends. And how are you? Welcome.
I am super
Welcome
good.
Back.
I feel great.
We're talking golf.
We're talking golf.
Urban golf.
Well, that, of course, is the theme to the hilarious golf movie Caddyshack. But let me tell you.
Love that movie.
Oh, yeah. It's not as good as Animal House, but
pretty good.
What is?
It's right up there.
What is? But Caddyshack ain't got nothing on this wacky golfing event called Downtown Open Urban Golf Tournament that uses downtown landmarks, rooftops, sidewalks, and bars, especially bars.
Wow.
Right? A beer and a putt and a beer and a putt, right? It takes place, well, basically from noon to 6-ish on Saturday.
Wow.
The fun gets started at Washington Square Park, also known as the clubhouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's just now sold out for participants who ponied up $20 or $25 to actually be provided clubs and provided these little sort of like dimpled foam balls so that they're not like ruining statues downtown or anything like that. So you can't be a golfer now unless you've already signed up. But you can be in the gallery at Washington Park, and they've got food trucks and music and entertainment and live fun games all day long. The casual competition actually wraps up with the final 16th hole. Why 16? I don't know. Next year, maybe 18, at Washington Square Park. So think of it as a golfing pub crawl, I guess, and be there at the end to cheer them on.
That sounds good.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
Talking 9 to 5, the musical, and man, this movie, this story has endured, hasn't it?
It's not going to go away.
It's
even
amazing.
Though we sit here in 2017, and we are sitting, by the way, listeners, if you're wondering, we're not on our chairs yet.
Yes.
But we sit here in 2017, and the behaviors of the male chauvinist pig boss in the original 1980 film 9 to 5 seem outlandish.
Is it 1980?
1980.
Yeah. Wow.
So all that crazy stuff with the way the gals were treated and kept back and put down and made fun of and sexualized, let's hope. I know we've made progress since then, right? But the reason, to your point, the reason it endures is lots of people remember way back when. And it's not gone. It's not fixed.
Right.
It's not as it should be yet. So, and with music and words and music by the great Dolly Parton, right, who actually wrote the tunes for the Broadway show version, you can check it out, 9 to 5, the musical. Performances tonight, Friday and Saturday night. There's a matinee Sunday in honor of Mother's Day, mimosas with mom before the 3 o'clock matinee on Sunday, right?
Yeah.
Where else but the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater? They do lots of classy work, not to say this isn't classy, but they're reaching out to the masses with this one, and they're going to crowd them in. They're going to have a great time.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 Things to Do with Mom in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
It's now or never.
Now or never because...
Okay, I'm probably over-dramatizing this, which is shocking because I'm pretty laid back. It really feels to me, and I'd love to get your input on this, like now or never for the Kansas City Royals this weekend.
That's right.
Feels like it. So they take on
the Baltimore Orioles.
Right. So here's my hope for this weekend. May motherly love fill Kauffman Stadium this weekend and inspire our woefully struggling Royals to smash dead the Orioles. Kill them, wipe them out. Because what's wrong with co-opting a little motherly love for a few wins? I'm sure Mom would go along with that, right?
Yeah.
What do you think their chances are if they drop, you know, three in a row, Friday and Saturday and Sunday?
I don't know.
Good.
Not good.
No, they're not good. It was
torture.
Not
good now.
It's
torture.
But I can't stop watching.
Yeah.
I was talking to my mother, by the way, and she says, she watches. She's actually got more patience than I do. I was her firstborn, so you know, she had a lot of patience with me. But just in case you don't have any faith in the Royals anymore, try to get it back. But if you can't, you can also show up on Saturday, be one of the first 20,000 fans to get a Danny Duffy bobblehead on Saturday, or be one of the first 10,000 female fans on Sunday and get a lady sun hat. And between you and me, and I'm going to say the wrong thing, forgive me, Mom, but I'm still waiting for the return of Royals Halter Top Day. You think we'll ever get that one again?
Stop it.
I can't stop.
Okay.
I just stopped.
Emmys for the million things she gave. All means only that she's growing old. Tears for the tears we'll shed to save me. Inches for her heart of pure gold.
And what do we have here?
Okay.
Something else for Mom.
It's a mom-centric weekend to-do
list.
Yes, it is. Okay, so yes, moms get, rightly so, free admission and a carnation. Several colors available, I'm told, by zoo personnel.
At the Kansas City Zoo.
At the Kansas City Zoo on Mother's Day. Several colors available to moms.
I love details, and you've got them.
Well, I
like that about you.
I like to keep them vaguely particular. Yes. Anyway, but of course you've got lots of animals there, too. You've got the gorilla mom, Makari, and her little, small for a gorilla daughter, Masika, and the orangutan mom, Josie, and her youngster, Dusty. So anyway, go check it out. Get a good feeling about Mom all day Sunday at the Kansas City Zoo.
And finally today.
Uh-huh.
Well, they'll stone you when you're trying to be so good. They'll stone you just like they said they would.
What do we have here?
Okay, so this weekend is the Kansas City Ballet's Director's Choice, okay? Performances Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Three, count them, three KC Dance premieres, including The Lottery. You read The Lottery as a kid in school. It's that famous 1948 short story about a backward small town's annual death by stoning event.
Oh,
so everybody must not get stoned, but in The Lottery, everybody gathers every year, and you pick a piece of paper, and if you get the one with the black dot in the middle, sorry. You're stoned. So don't pick that piece of paper. But it'll be a very interesting director's choice assemblage of material at 7:30 tonight. No, Friday night, Saturday night, and a Mother's Day matinee for the Kansas City Ballet on Sunday at the Kauffman Center
and
for the Performing Arts.
And that's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list.
That was me.
Thanks, man.
Yes,
appreciate
ma'am.
It.
Yep.
On tomorrow's show, there's a new documentary out about jazz legend John Coltrane, and it's good. We'll talk with the filmmaker. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.